the volume.
The Colin Cowherd Podcast brought to you by FanDuel. It's never been easier to play fantasy on FanDuel. Whether you love basketball, golf, soccer, or any fantasy sport, there is a contest for every fan. FanDuel, more ways to win. All right, it's President's Day. It's Monday. What do you think? I'm taking it off? I only take Super Bowl week off. I'll get to that in a second. Joe Buck is a contemporary, but in my opinion, he's the voice of my generation. He's humble and won't admit it, but as I've said to Troy Aikman recently, he's the only guy I go into a room with. I get a little nervous. I want to be very respectful to Joe. I listen to his dad growing up. Joe doesn't know this, but years ago, I was out of college, I was a AAA baseball announcer, and I would get all the media guides from minor league teams. And there was this one kid named Joe Buck, because I got a job out of college doing one inning of play-by-play in Vegas. And you were in, I think, Louisville. And I'm like, oh, he thinks he's going to beat me to the bigs. It's not going to happen. So I was competing against you. I was 21 years old at Eastern Washington University. I want to start with this, because I had a recent health scare, and they can't quite figure it out. I had a little pulmonary embolism, and it was unprovoked, meaning I wasn't pregnant. It wasn't a flying issue. I don't have clots in my family. It wasn't immobility. And I thought to myself, you know, I fly a little bit. So earlier this year, I want to read our audience this, Joe. This was your schedule. Sunday, Bucks Packers. Monday's Bills Chiefs. Tuesday, World Series Game 1. Wednesday, World Series Game 2. Thursday, Giants, Eagles. Friday, World Series Game 3. Saturday, World Series Game 4. Are there times you have to perform at the highest level and you are exhausted?
Oh, my God, yeah. I have so many things I want to say about the beginning of this podcast. First of all, I read about that, and that's scary with you. And I'm sure you'll be able to get to the bottom of it eventually. As far as you looking at other media guides, at no point was I thinking I was going to beat anybody to the big leagues. I was somebody's son. I was Jack Buck's son. So I had a leg up or two legs up on everybody else, as I was like the second banana in Louisville behind a guy who I love like a brother, Jim Kelch, who did not have to be as welcoming to me, a guy who worked his way up to AAA, and there I was being inserted at AAA, and I was 19 years old, and he and his wife and his little kids kind of took me in as a de facto member of the family. And I don't feel like I'm a voice of the generation. I feel like I'm blended in behind a couple of guys that have been doing it a lot longer than I have. And I was just the luckiest guy in the world. Have I done games exhausted? Yes. I remember in 96, I was 27, and this just shows you how it all started. I was 27, and I was broadcasting the World Series at Yankee Stadium, and game one gets rained out, and so we missed the travel day. Game one ended up the next day, and so there was no travel day. We traveled all night. I got to Atlanta, and I'd never had a cup of coffee in my life. And I was like, man, I hope I don't go on the air tired. And I was exhausted because I didn't sleep. I was nervous. And we flew overnight. And I tried coffee for the first time. And now I can't function without 28 cups a day. So, yeah, I'm tired. But once they kick it off or they throw the first pitch, that goes out the window. And I'll sleep on the plane or I'll sleep during the morning and go do the game. I mean, there's nothing that brings somebody to life, or at least me to life, like doing a big league event. And if the day ever comes where I roll into that booth and that day's event doesn't wake me up, no matter how tired I've been, then it's time to quit. So the tiredness goes away, and you just focus in on what you're doing.
Joe Buck joining us, Colin Cowherd Podcast. So, you know, I told Troy this. I said, every broadcast partnership has a different feel. Regardless of who is the analyst, Al Michaels always feels like he's leading the broadcast. Tony Romo is the energizer to Nance. You and Aikman are different. You sound like college buddies. you sound like you both have a small glass of bourbon that you sip occasionally during the game, and it's an incredibly comfortable experience for me as a consumer. And I'll ask you what I asked Troy. How long did it take to curate that?
Oh, it took longer for Troy and me to get there than it took Smoltz and I to get there. And I'll say this, we have had that glass of bourbon in the booth, although it's not bourbon. It's tequila, splash of Grand Marnier, and grapefruit juice. I went through a couple of years where in the first inning of every postseason baseball game, I had the runner go get the biggest beer that the stadium sold. And I had it sitting there and I would sip it from time to time to remind myself to relax and have fun. I'm just doing a game. And I did that. I brought that over to football, but because Troy is a man of finer tastes, beer somehow became tequila, Grand Marnier, and grapefruit juice. We haven't done it in a long time now, but it was good for a stretch. And I feel like it's a good mental trigger to just chill and remind yourself that you're not refueling an F-16 in mid-flight. You're doing a sporting event. And if you treat it like anything other than that, you're doing yourself a disservice. So I'm glad you say that. I agree with what you say about Al. I think Al leads. Chris is a strong personality.
Yes.
A great compliment to Al. But Al has a lot of room. I try to use the littlest amount of room I can to leave the most amount of space between plays or after a play for Troy. And it works. And I'm there to support him. He's there to listen and support me. And that's a legitimate friendship that I'm glad comes across because we have it. We text each other, and Aaron Andrews is part of it. We text each other all week, and we text each other during the offseason. We are legitimate friends, and I would consider him one of my three or four best friends in the world. And I'm fortunate that I have that with somebody that I'm in that high pressure of a situation with.
You've been on so many big games. When do you get the feeling in a game? You probably got this with that Cubs World Series, that you're in a game and maybe you turn to Smoltz or Aikman and you're like, this is one for the ages. This is our best game of the year. That's got to be an electric goosebump feeling. There's not a lot of those, Joes. I did play by play for a couple of years. You get about four a year. But, I mean, maybe take me to the last one. Take me to a memorable one.
Yeah, I think, you know, in football, it doesn't happen like it does in baseball, for whatever reason, at least to me. I think in football, I remember having that feeling the second Super Bowl we did, which was Super Bowl 42, the Giants and the Patriots, with the Patriots going for 19-0 and the Giants in this out-of-nowhere postseason by Eli. And that game was going back and forth in the fourth quarter. And it was like, man, we went to commercial and Troy and I are looking at each other almost like you don't want to talk to somebody during a no-hitter because you just know the audience is beyond your comprehension. The stakes are at their highest in our profession and you don't want to mess it up. And it was like my heart was in my throat, not because I was worried about it, but because the game was that good. And you're right. I mean, the Red Sox Yankees, that those two LCSs in 03 and 04, and then the Red Sox coming back in 04 and just blowing the Cardinals out of the stadium in 04, but knowing that it had been 86 years and nobody had ever screamed on TV that the Red Sox were world champions, that to me is like, damn, don't mess this up. And when the Cubs came around and they hadn't won in 108 years, they had the Game 7 lead, blew the lead. Now we're going to extra innings. You get done with the ninth inning and I looked at John and John looked at me and it's like, we have history on our hands here. And not only did we get seven games, you don't know, it could be a four game sweep, but now we're getting extra innings of game seven. And that was as intense a moment as I've ever been in a baseball booth. And you're right. I mean, there are times where the moment, it's almost like when a server sets a plate down and they go, our plates are really hot, don't touch it. Well, I go, well, let's see how hot really hot is to you. I'm going to touch it. Or, you know, the Poseidon Adventure and Ernest Borgnine, they're climbing a ladder, don't look down. The first thing I would do is look down and probably fall into a boiling cauldron of water and die at the base of the Poseidon. So you almost have to trick yourself into not getting swallowed up by the moment, and then you think about it after the fact.
The next time you're watching basketball, I've got the perfect way for you to get in on the action for free. I'm talking about NBA InPlay. Absolutely free to play on the FanDuel app and features all the fun of live betting. NBA InPlay turns every quarter of every game into a free contest where you can win real cash prizes. So while you're watching the game, all you have to do is predict the outcomes of plays and game props before they happen to claim your share of the prize pool. Best of all, a new contest starts every quarter of every game, giving you even more ways to win. FanDuel is the exclusive home for NBA InPlay, so the action is always available right at your fingertips on the FanDuel app. The app is easy to use. It takes less than 2 minutes to sign up. I did. It's a breeze. And it doesn't matter where you live or where you're traveling to, because NBA InPlay is available in every state. Don't miss your shot. Get in the game and download the FanDuel app to start playing NBA InPlay today. Joe Buck on the Colin Cowherd podcast. So you were 25 when you got your first slate of games for Fox. I think Costas was like 28, which I always thought was remarkable. At that point, I knew both of you. He was hosting more than doing play. I think he did play-by-play at Missouri at 27, 28. You got a full slate of games. And who was your partner the first year?
Tim Green. Who
smart guy.
Smart guy. And battling ALS and is a hero to so many. I mean, the guy was top of his class at Syracuse, was a first-round pick by Atlanta, smallish defensive end, just played and succeeded on grit. And then when we started in 94, he was getting his law degree. He passed the bar, and he has since written like 20 novels, fictional novels about sports, baseball, football, you name it. I mean, he's like Aikman in that there are more hours in their days than I have in mind. I just marvel at what they do. So, yeah, I mean, he was just off the field, had never broadcast anything. I was 25 going in as Jack Buck's son and had never broadcast football before. And Fox drops out of space into the NFL, and they hire a bunch of young guys, and there I am at Soldier Field on opening day in 1994, like, what in the hell am I doing here, and how am I going to get through the next 3 hours? And then you get through it, and you know, you get better and better.
Yeah, you know, the NFL is interesting. You know, I think baseball was always seen as the thinking man's sport, more of a chess match than checkers. The NFL does one thing really, really well. They move off things. If something doesn't work, a rule, legislation, they move off it. Replay. Baseball, which has this sort of cerebral essence, sometimes can be the rigidity inside the sport can drive me crazy. It's like 162 games. Can we scale back to 120? You've at times voiced, you know, concern about that, but I think it's the reality of what the sport is. I think both did really well in the pandemic. When you broadcast a game for Fox, whether it's baseball or the NFL, have there ever been moments that I think they would almost always stay out of it, but you guys are opinionated. You and Aikman have opinions. The last 2 years have been dicey on the social front for broadcasters. A lot of opinion people get in trouble. Have you felt over the last year an eggshell moment or in either sport, I got to watch where I step here. Do you ever feel that?
Yeah, because it's hard to talk about really complex social issues that affect a lot of people and people feel really passionate about in and around play-by-play of a baseball game or a football game. It's almost impossible to do. So whether it's Colin Kaepernick kneeling years ago or coming into this season, coming off everything that's happened in 2020, or in baseball, you know, if you want to bring it down to what you talked about with regard to the game. And I think some of where baseball is losing its audience. You have to really be careful and almost map out exactly where you're going to go verbally so you don't mess it up. because
yeah, I do the same thing.
You feel the constraints and the pressure of time. Like we're coming back from break, and obviously Fox or any network is squeezing every minute, second, nanosecond they can get out of a commercial break to maximize what they can make. So you're up against it going to break and up against it coming out of break. And so it's like, I don't have a lot of time here to go into something that's really affecting a lot of people's lives and people feel really passionate about. So I'm going to get into it. I'm going to try to be smart about what I say, present both sides of the argument, and then go back to doing what I'm paid to do. Otherwise, if you start fumbling for words and stumbling around, I just think good luck, because you're probably going to say the wrong thing most of the time unintentionally, but you know, all those filters have to be put into place, and it's a high wire act more now than it's ever been.
So in my space, it's easier than it's ever been. You used to have to read a bunch of newspapers, wait for the AP wire, talk about every sport. And then about 15 years ago, I stopped talking about tennis or regular season baseball much. I never felt a need to talk about hockey playoffs because of NHL TV, Major League Baseball TV, Tennis Channel, Golf Channel. So it allowed me to do a 65% football show, 20% college football show, 25% NBA. So I don't feel like I'm a newspaper anymore, which I did when I started in this business 25 years ago. So the job is easier. I have to be really good on the NFL, know the top college football, top NBA stories, and then a big fight, a big golf event, which I like anyway. Is your job harder or easier today?
I think it's harder. It's more dangerous. You know, like I want to come on your podcast and I want to be entertaining. I want to be funny. I want to be as loose as I can be. But you can get into a lot of trouble these days trying to be, to use the Tom Cruise word, glib. And you can really get into a lot of trouble. And Troy and I talked about this way back in the day when Chris, Troy, and I were together. It's almost like, why do I, unless this show is called the Joe Buck Show, and even then, you're hesitant because you can cost yourself a career. But I'm not going to go on Poughkeepsie All Sports Radio and just lay it all out there and be an asshole and try to be the funniest guy in the room, because then that gets sold up the line. And then I might as well have said what I'm saying on, there is no more small radio appearance that you're going to go on. If you say something dumb enough or something that's pushing it as far as you can push it, or some controversial take that, can you believe Joe Buck just said this? It's going everywhere. What's the positive? Why do I want to deal with all the fallout that's going to come out of me probably trying to be a smartass instead of being real or making some real serious point? It's just not worth it. So for that, you know, doing live sports on TV with that microphone in front of your face. I mean, I still have people talking to me about the Randy Moss moment. And when I said, that's disgusting, when he fake mooned the crowd and then rubbed his backside against the goalpost. And, you know, that was, I think, 2004 or something like that. And that, other than that, you know, it's like, you want to dip your toe into that water? Good luck. And it's the fallout and the aftermath is just not worth the actual moment in time when you're trying to be funny. So I think it's way harder now than it's ever been. And sorry to keep going, but you think about my dad's career, Harry Carey's career, Bob Prince's career, these guys that, I mean, I don't know that my dad had any filters. If he did, he got the benefit of the doubt broadcasting for the Cardinals all those years because he knew so many people, was out. People knew he had a good heart. He was raising money. It wasn't taken in a way that was so, everybody's ready to be offended. But man, until this country takes a breath and has a big old timeout and everybody can reset, which I don't know when, where, or how that's going to happen, I'll just stay in my lane and do my job and talk to my wife at night.
Yeah. You know, it's, I'll get personal. So my favorite night is Ann and I go out, cocktails. Sometimes it's in Park City. We have a little place there. Cocktails, dinner, and turn music on. And just, especially 70s, 80s, really bad music. And listen to it. And it really gets us emotional. It takes us back to, you know, simpler times. She grew up in Birmingham, Michigan. I grew up on the coast of Washington, very small, wet town. And those were great nights for us. We just, the kids were out of the house. We're staring at the mountains. What is a great night for Joe Buck? What is a perfect night for Joe Buck?
I mean, that it's not too different. I think I could be married to Ann. and you could be married.
She'll
to
call
Michelle.
You out in your shit, man. She calls me out on mine.
We'll do the the Yankees wife swap thing. Not in that sense, but you know, see if you can entertain Michelle like, and I can entertain Ann. So it's not any different. I mean, we are really, and thank God, we are really quiet people. And I understand, you know, when I look back on, you know, why Letterman became a hermit, or that's what you heard about Johnny Carson, or we did, yeah. Michelle and I last night, you know, you open up a bottle of wine, which before Michelle, who I married in 2014, before her, I was like a beer guy, vodka guy. Now it's wine. It's got to be wine. And now I'm like one of those guys that I used to just detest, you know, just like talking about how great. Can't stand that, but now I'm that person. But opening that up, we watched the Britney Spears documentary last night and talked about a lot of it. It's long. It's that pack of lunch on that thing, and the point's driven home about 7,000 times in that documentary. But just sitting around on our couch, the boys, we have 2.5-year-old twins. Once it's finally quiet in their room and you have that like exhale moment, just being together, watching something, listening to something. She and I mean, she's a dancer. So, I mean, if I really want to have a shot, I will dance with her in our bedroom. And then, you know, the odds go up. So that's what we do. It's not any different. But we'd like to go out, like to go out to dinner. But yeah. We're not like bar hopping and going to clubs and all that. I have no time really for any of that stuff. Go to a good place for dinner. Have a great meal. Great couple drinks, go home, and just be together.
Yeah, that's my night too. So you don't talk about politics. You can't. I can a little. I'm a pretty independent guy. Lean left socially, pretty moderate fiscally. You know, I was not a fan of Trump. I had too much anxiety for me. I'm more of a peacemaker guy than
I got so tired of. I'm everything you just said is really who I am too. And I know you're about to make a point, but it just was day after day of when you'd wake up and it was like another thing shot across my phone. I'm like, I'm just not wired for the intensity that's coming my way every day. So I don't get into politics. I see both sides of it. I marvel, as I'm sure you do, at the coverage of the same incident or the same law or the same candidate. And looking at different presentations of these things from the different television networks, it's fascinating to me. So I'm more of like an observer than I am anything else. But go ahead, finish your point.
Well, my question was, I'm able to dabble in it 2 minutes a week. So you don't have a moment because you're restricted by the broadcast. You don't have that moment driving home thinking, you know, I'd love to take a shot at this politician or have an opinion on this. No. You don't miss that. That's no.
I don't. I just don't. Again, I mean, for the fallout that'll come after it, if you made
right,
you know, it speaks to everything that I think is wrong about where we are socially, where people can't disagree, and if you say something that more people disagree with and are loud about, you may find yourself on the outside looking in at your old job. And that's a scary place to be. So my mind doesn't even go there. So I'm not a hyperventilating guy that's worried about stuff day to day. That's why I say that with my phone, it was just like, I got another thing happen or another, you know, change. And I just, it just becomes too much for me. So I'm really good at compartmentalizing, and I'm good at just shoving that out over here and letting that live over there. And whoever ends up getting elected, I'll root for him, because at my core, I'm an American, and that's the kind of stuff I learned from my dad.
Yeah. So my wife about 10 years ago said, hey, you got to figure out some tech because our kids are going to get on it. And you don't want to get blindsided. So I'm on Facebook, and I Instagram, and I monitor my daughter, blah, blah, blah. So your kids are, you know, your two-year-olds are still a few years away from TikTok. But how techie is Joe Buck? What do you get?
Really
what
not.
Do you do?
Yeah, I mean, but I have 24 and 21-year-old daughters too. Once I knew that them being pushed out of the nest, that they were smart and knew, you know, I grew up in a small town, St. Louis, with a certainly a locally famous dad. And I knew that eyes were on us. I knew that eyes were on us when we walked into a restaurant. I knew that eyes were on me if I was at a party in high school. I knew that if I was in a car full of kids that got pulled over for underage possession of alcohol, it was going to be my name and the others behind my name, because it was my dad. And so I grew up that way. And my daughters have had to deal with that. And I feel like they've been really smart on social media. And now that I don't worry about that anymore with them. And I've kind of gotten away from it a little bit. When I took Instagram off my phone, it was a really nice moment. Now I'm on Instagram, but I have people that I pay to put stuff up on Instagram. If I feel like, my wife, Michelle Beisner, did a thing on ESPN on the relationship of Pat and Marty Schottenheimer that I posted last night, because I'm so proud of it, because it just speaks to everything. My grandfather had Alzheimer's. That's the one that played for the Chicago Bears. I don't know if it was dementia brought on, you know, CTE before they knew what CTE was, or if he just had Alzheimer's. And to watch Pat and Marty, and Pat just watch out for Marty, and the love between those two, like that was really special. So I got on and I put that up on Twitter. But otherwise, the less I'm on that stuff, the less I'm even aware of it, the happier I feel like I am.
So you're still based in St. Louis, right?
Yes.
And you could live anywhere.
Yes. And the answer to your question is, at some point, every grain of sand will fall out of the top of the hourglass, and my wife, Michelle, who's from Denver and then lived in L.A. While she worked at NFL Network and transitioned to ESPN, is going to want to get out of here for at least a chunk of the year, because I am staring out above my computer screen at, like, parts of Moscow outside my window. It is 20. There's snow on the ground. It's gray. And there are better, warmer places this time of year. So at some point, we will find better, warmer climates to at least be there in, what is this, February 10th.
Yeah, it's funny. Everybody always bangs on LA. I get it. It's expensive. The taxes are brutal. But I went for an hour walk this morning, and it was like sunny. And I could hear the beach.
Man.
And I always say, I'm like, people, come on. Listen, I'm not a tax gypsy. Every place I've lived has taxes. And my wife always says it. She says, L.A. is expensive. So's filet mignon.
Right.
So's Mercedes-Benz. Like, right. Nice stuff costs money.
Yeah.
So I always defend L.A.
And you should. And I, you know, but we both have friends that are getting tired of Los Angeles these days.
Yeah.
And it's a real thing with people leaving there. But every time, for every one of those stories, I have another one of these gray days, and I'm like, that's the number one thing that my wife Michelle is just like, if we could just get outside with the boys. I mean, if it's just 2.5 years old wanting to run around, wanting to get fresh
sure.
air, wanting, and it is freezing outside right now in the Midwest. So I love it. I love the slow life, the quiet life, the easy to get around. There's great restaurants here, great hospitals, great schools, and it's easy in and out for me. And there's a value for that that I enjoy. But the weather is a big deal with these kids, and we're getting pulled for sure.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. So you don't get a lot of breaks, but now is sort of the time. It feels to me like you got about 45 days of Joe Buck living his best life with his kids and Michelle. So what would Joe Buck do for the next 45?
Well, I feel like we wake up at, and people have way harder lives than we do, certainly than I do. But it is full on now, like payback time for being gone as much as I'm gone with the aforementioned calendar. So I'm get up in the morning and it's like, what can we do to get to nap time? And then it's after nap time, what can we do to get to that moment when the room's quiet and Michelle and I are on the couch watching something, splitting a bottle of wine. And so there's not a whole hell of a lot going on around here, and we're in a pandemic. So we have a nanny who we love. My sister's here. My mom's here, which is, those are two big reasons why I'm still here. And so we're around the house trying to read an Ayn Rand book, which I will be 90 and 1 foot in the grave, Lord willing, by the time I get halfway through this thing. It's unreal, but I'm trying to just slow down, enjoy myself, enjoy the quiet when there is quiet. And then, I got in trouble with you a long time ago when I flippantly said, when you said, you know, are you watching the West Coast games on MLB Network every night watching Major League Baseball? And at that time I was a young dad with two daughters and I was like, no, I mean, I know what's going on. I can read, but no, I'm not up all night watching West Coast games. I'm raising daughters. My wife and I are going to watch The Bachelorette or whatever it is. And people freaked out that I'm just not 24/7 baseball. And so I try to get away from it for my own sanity. And contrary to everything I've said in this podcast to this point, I really don't care if somebody has an opinion on me not immersing myself in baseball every day. I have to do more than that for my own mind's health.
Yeah, I always say, like sports, love my life. I mean, that's kind of my worldview on it. So I want to ask a couple of intense sports questions. You do these pre-prod meetings. You do them on probably Friday, Saturday, where you sit down with a Belichick or a Brady before games. When's the last time that you and Troy were actually in that meeting and you walked out of the meeting, both teams, and you felt like, wow, one team really has an advantage here? Like, you really sensed the meeting felt substantially more concrete. You had a not an epiphany, but a strong feeling about those pre-prod meetings, of which you've done 1,000.
Yeah. The one that sticks out to me forever is when Seattle was playing Denver in that Super Bowl. And my wife is a former Broncos cheerleader prior to her transition into the media side of things. And she is all Denver Broncos. I mean, it's Peyton Manning. It was Russell Wilson's, second year in the league. And that was a Legion of Boom. And when we talked to, first we talked to Seattle. Yeah, we talked to Seattle first. And we were going to talk just to Earl Thomas. And they said, no, they want to do it all together. And they all sat in there, and Cam Chancellor looked like he wanted to take my head off 4 days before the Super Bowl started. And Richard, I mean, think about that group. And Earl Thomas and everybody else that was in there, the room was full. And I've never seen a look in the eyes of a group of people that were like, there is no chance in hell we are going to lose this game. And I went back to the room. My wife was with me at the time. And I said, babe, I got bad news for you. Your Broncos have no shot. And doing a Super Bowl for 100 million people, and the first friggin' snap from center went over the head of Peyton Manning, and it was on. And then, you know, it was a rout in the first half, and Troy and I are trying to justify it at halftime. And like, okay, this is going to, because it's intense. You're like, my God, nobody's going to watch this thing. Or what are we going to do? We have nothing. The game's terrible. And we're like, okay, It's Peyton Manning, for God's sake. They're going to come back. They're going to come back. And then they kick off to Seattle to open the second half, and Percy Harvin runs it back for a touchdown. And I like threw my pen down. That is the one thing that we are all guilty of. Everybody always says, oh, you hate my team. You suck. You hate the Cardinals. People in St. Louis think I hate the Cardinals because you're not doing it from either side's perspective. But all we're ever guilty of rooting for is just a good game. I don't care who wins.
Yeah.
I just want it exciting until the end, and then may the better team win. And when you're doing a game of that magnitude and the thing has absolutely no drama, it is really, that's when the job is hard.
All the times you've met. Now, again, you're NFC. You didn't get Brady a lot. You got a lot of Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson. Of all the great quarterbacks you get, who's the most honest? Who's the most piercing? Who do you feel you get? When he talks, you watch the game, and he laid it out for you.
Three guys. Brett Favre, Aaron Rodgers, and it's become Tom Brady. And you're right. I personally don't know. I've been in a room with Tom Brady maybe three times, four times. I think Dan said the other night he's doing his 100th Tom Brady game. I haven't done 10, I bet. Or if I did, if I've done 10, seven of them came in 2020. So because he's in the AFC, and I don't know that people totally get the idea that Fox has NFC, CBS has had AFC, but we just haven't had him a lot. But he is really, really honest. I think a lot of these guys, and they're the three best that I think I've ever talked to, but they're all pretty good. I feel like they all treat it like therapy. They know what they say in there is not going to come back and bite them, because we're smart enough to know what they want said and what they don't. And what they don't want said, they're saying it for a reason, but you also can file it away and say, okay, this is why this happened. This is why Favre is not throwing to Antonio Freeman today. This is why, you can't come out and say, you know, he doesn't think Freeman's running great because he's got a bad hamstring or whatever it is. But by the halftime, you're like, man, Antonio Freeman's got two catches. What's going on? Well, we know. But you can't say it. But it's that kind of trust that you've built up over 20-plus years that they know they're not going to be embarrassed by something they say in there, and they treat it like they're on the couch and they can gripe and they want to hear Troy's opinion on what they're dealing with, from either quarterback down the chain to players or quarterback up the chain to coordinator and head coach. And it's fascinating to listen to. Most of it you can't use, but it's definitely helpful.
When's the last game you did? And it doesn't have to be significant, but it was just 3.5 hours of fun. Whether it's Smoltz or Aikman, you found yourself laughing. It was weird. It didn't make sense. It could have been a bit of a hot mess. And you did a game, and you literally left and put the headset down and thought, that's why I got in the business. That was great.
We did an extra inning game in this last NLCS between Atlanta and the Dodgers. I don't know what game it was. I could dig my scorebook out right now. But I was out of my mind. And I was doing like a Wolf Blitzer impersonation. and I kept going back to Wolf Blitzer, who clearly was not in the booth. But I was doing this voice of Wolf Blitzer. And it was John brought up something that CNN was going to do a story on back in his days in Atlanta with the Braves. And I, you know, brought up some stupid example of Wolf Blitzer and just kept going back to it. And we were just giddy. And I think it was just, you're at the end of this run and you're in a neutral site, and it was extra innings. And it was just like, I put the headset down. I remember telling our producer, Pete Macheska, and John, I was like, that felt like local baseball. That felt like how I started. Where I would just say whatever came to mind, and I'd have friends who would text me words. I'd bet them $50 that I could get the word in the broadcast. And they're like, you can't get octopus in the broadcast. And I'm trying to think of some way to get it in. And at that point, there was so little integrity in what I was doing. I would just be like, and so at the end of four, it's the Cardinals 6, the Pirates 5, octopus. I didn't even try to work it in. I was like, said it, give me your $50. And that's the beauty of local baseball. At least back then it was. And that game between the Braves and the Dodgers, by the end of it, I felt like you better just stop because you're gonna go too far here.
By the way, how about the Dodgers picking up Trevor Bauer? It's funny. So you go Bueller to Trevor Bauer to Kershaw, David Price. I think 1 through 8.
Urias is pretty good.
It's 1 through 8. It's about as substantial a batting order as we've had since great Yankee teams. I said this on the air the other day. I said it has a chance, if the bullpen is moderate, to be the best baseball team we have had. And you're an expert on this, but they are stacked. I mean, it's incredible right now.
And they don't have a ton of money committed in the next 7-8 years. It's not like that's why they could pay Bauer $40 million, whatever the number is, for year one. And they can, I mean, Betts, yeah, that's how they sign Mookie Betts. They don't have a lot of deals that are like going to strangle them in the near future. And, you know, Dave Roberts is one of the great guys in the game. I mean, there is just almost, it's almost an embarrassment of riches there. It's almost too much. And they always say you can never have too much pitching. But I would say that of all those guys, at least going off this last October, the guy who has the best, and now Bueller I love, but the guy who has the best stuff, who's got the most confidence, who I would say go out there in any role, closer, setup, starter, game seven, don't, is Urias. I mean, his stuff is stunning, and more than Bauer, more than any of them. So I agree with you. I mean, we haven't seen a team like this with this kind of pitching. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
You know, Joe, I was thinking about this. I'm a believer in analytics, but what I reference on my show often is Manalytics, where it's analytics, but without turning alpha males into numbers and code, that you understand there are moments that you just let man, you're going to make a decision based on, I trust this guy.
Right.
And it may not be analytically great, but I trust the guy. I got to fly with him. I got to be in a plane with him. I got to be in a locker room. So,
How about this part of it? I've been on the plane with him. I've been in the locker room with him. I've been in the hotel bar with him the night before. I know that he's in a horrible disagreement with his significant other. I know that he stayed at the bar too late last night. Not everything fits into an equation. It's absurd. Analytics has its place. There is no doubt about it. But if you take the ability for a manager to look into somebody's eyes and determine if that person is fit or not to go out there and win that inning or that at bat or that game, if that manager doesn't have that freedom, I think you've completely missed the point of what sports is all about. Whatever the analytics said Derek Jeter was defensively at shortstop, if the bases are loaded in the mid-90s, early 2000s, ninth inning, game seven, and somebody hits a bullet at one of the infielders, who do you think, of the four guys standing out there, who do you think's the one guy saying, God, I hope he hits it to me? It's Jeter. I don't care what his analytics, what the numbers say, that his range is. And that's how it is. These pitching changes are being made at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the game unfolds, and you're in the seventh inning and the guy's mowing people down and all of a sudden he's coming out. I mean, that stuff drives me crazy because you're taking the human element out of the game. There's no doubt there's a spot for analytics. It's a way to quantify things. But quantifying somebody's heart, quantifying somebody's confidence, quantifying somebody's amount of rest that day, no matter what the numbers say, man, if you're going to throw all that out just to look at numbers, good luck.
Hey, you have a podcast. It's, if I recall, it's Oliver Hudson, you talk about daddy issues.
Yeah.
I am. Oh, boy. That's a Listen, I got six kids. I would love to give you great advice, but shit, I'm making it up every day. I don't even know
what
I'm doing.
We all are. My daddy issues are all from kind of the good side of it, because I idolized my dad. He was my best friend. I followed him into the business. Oliver's dad walked out on Goldie Hawn and Kate Hudson and Oliver when Oliver was 6 or 8 years old. And then Kurt Russell came into their lives, and he's everything you think he would be as a person, and to Oliver as a dad, taught him everything he knows. But he's got, you know, why did my dad walk out? Real daddy issues. And everybody we've talked to, from Barkley to Vedder to Sandler to Spade to, you know, that kind of a list of people, having that through line, and sometimes it's my dad was my best friend, and sometimes it's I couldn't stand my dad, and here's why. That's been the fun part of it for us, and since Oliver and I come at it from different perspectives, it's been worthwhile. So it's been good.
I saw your dad MC an event in San Diego, if I recall, the baseball winter meetings. He was sensational. You are equally sensational as a moderator and a host. Your dad was really set the table for
you. Yep.
He was laugh out loud funny.
Yeah.
And I imagine you went to a lot of those.
Oh, my God. I mean, those are my favorite times. And again, I got in trouble for this when I wrote my book, because I pointed out how it was just a different time. And I'm not saying it was better then. I'm not saying it was worse then. I'm just saying it was different. So I remember as a young announcer being with the Cardinals, the Cardinals have two events that the players, I don't know if it's in their contract or what, but they have to go to these two banquets every year. It was called the Knights of the Cauliflower Ear, and they had a breakfast, and it was 8 o'clock in the morning, and these players are staggering in, bleary-eyed. Team got in from Houston the night before, and my dad gets up there and says, pardon me, folks, we're having a little bit of a rough morning. It was a late night last night, late in Houston. Team lost 6-4, as I'm sure most of you know. Our plane landed at midnight. We were in the arms of our loved ones at 1:30 in the morning and home with our wives at 6. And that, and like the place went nuts. And now I think of, if I said that in 2021, even though it's a complete joke and like a Shecky Green thing, you know, like, take my wife, please. Like we're in the Borscht Belt or something. I don't know. It's not anything that I would say. So that, I mean, that was the kind of humor that he would do, especially in a closed room. And I saw that stuff with no cell phones and no, before all that stuff. So if you were there, you had stories for days. If you weren't there, you weren't seeing like somebody sneaking under the table at table 19, shooting a video of Jack Buck saying something that probably would upset some folks. So just a different time.
Yeah, I remember it well. He had a lot of those sort of stories and lines. Peter Ueberroth was the commissioner. I had just gotten out of college, and Jack Buck was hired to MC an event, and he was hysterical. I mean, it was, you know, it's funny. I was, not to bore you, when I got out of college, I wanted to be a AAA, I wanted to be a baseball announcer. And I moved to Las Vegas. I got a job doing one inning of play-by-play for the Las Vegas Stars and selling ads. And it was a big jump. I went, you know, from college, a tape, to AAA. And I jumped over a lot of more talented guys. And a lot of the guys that were in the PCL are now in the big leagues. They're, you know, real competent guys. And I remember one of the things, a local station had Vin Scully. KDWN, KDON had Vin Scully. So I'd heard Scully bits and pieces, but now I listen to him every day. And Vin was so good, he was discouraging.
Yeah.
And I remember listening to him thinking, well, that's Shakespeare. I can't do that. Your dad had a similar ability, and I remember it in San Diego. He was so comfortable talking. I've never been completely comfortable. I have to prep a lot. That's when I think of your dad. I almost think of like he just talked And then they sat him down in a game, and he kept talking.
Yeah, well, the conversation to a degree. I mean, I think when he first got to St. Louis, and he was working with Harry Carey and Joe Garagiola, I mean, that was an unbelievable broadcast booth. He did every speaking event he could get his hands on in the city, and he said he was so nervous. I mean, he grew up Holyoke, Massachusetts, and then outside of Cleveland. Was a Depression-era kid, shot in World War II, only went to Ohio State because of the GI Bill. I mean, he came from zero, and now he's standing in front of big crowds in a major league city, and he said his knees were shaking, and he had to hold on to the podium so tightly because he was shaking, and he didn't want anybody to see it. And for a guy to go from that when he was in his 20s to early 30s, however old he was, to where he ended, you're right. I mean, he was not a guy that would wear you out. He was a guy that made you want to hear more. But
yes.
But it was just different. So if I grew up and Vin Scully was my dad, or I grew up in L.A. and I heard Vin Scully every day, my style would be entirely different. My dad had more of kind of a laid-back style. Vin... In the with velvet gloves would grab a game by the throat, and it was his game, and he could weave stories in that went in and around play by play. I mean, it's just unbelievable how great of a wordsmith he is. Can't even say was. And so, I mean, he's the best. Vin to me is the best to ever do it. My dad was just different. And if I grew up on the East Coast, it would have been different from the other two. So it's almost like, where did you grow up? What kind of, you know, like a painter, who did you study and whose style did you pick up? And I happened to pick up my dad's because I was sitting in the booth watching him do it with a half a headset on my ear. And it would have been the same though, if I was just had the radio under my pillow. It just a different way of doing a game.
Yeah, I always think of you and your dad. The similarity is obvious to me because I'm old enough. I heard your dad. I heard him on NFL radio. I got a lot of your dad. And the similarity to me is you're both natural. You have very the cadence. You're both comfortable. And you also are very good in big moments. Both of you can go 0 to 60 in about a half a second, which is very difficult. You can go from moderate to, oh, my God, this is the end of the earth. Your dad could do the same thing. It's weird. I studied broadcasters. I had every tape of every Major League Baseball guy. Not much of a social life in college. But one of the things, your dad, I think he worked with Mike Shannon, the tapes I heard.
Yeah.
And similarly, you are the broadcaster that gets along with everybody. Your dad, perhaps, it was a different time. But I do think there's comfort with you. I feel like Joe Buck is comfortable. You make me comfortable. I'm at ease. The game comes to you. You don't have to reach out to it. So that's how I view you. And that's where I think you and your dad are very similar.
Yeah.
The game comes to you, and you just take us comfortably through it.
Yeah, I don't go into a game loaded for bear. I go into a game prepared, but I just want to see what happens. And I think sometimes that's taken by some as, oh, this guy's just an asshole. This guy's a smug guy. He's lucky his dad was famous. And you know, after almost 30 years at Fox, that – doesn't really make any more sense, but or if it ever did. But I do look at a game probably differently than most, and I am now the old guy doing baseball. I never thought I would be that guy, but I do yearn for the game I grew up on, and that's not what we see now. And I hear other broadcasters talking a lot about whether it's war or launch angle or spin rate or whatever, and I'm not yet convinced that that's what a general audience wants in October on a national broadcast. If you want that,
they don't.
Yeah. If you want that, you can find that. And so let those people go find that. And I'm not saying that there's no value in it. It's a way to quantify who's good, who's not in some realms. But I just try to keep it as simple and as free as I can. And then, as you say, when the big moment happens, you have to vocally get to the big moment so the people sit up a little bit and know that it's, in some cases, that this is the game's on the line right here. The game's not probably going to be on the line in the top of the second inning, and you can't go in and have the same acceleration every time you start talking. You have to change it up, and that's the best thing I get out of listening to my old stuff. It's like, I'm working too hard here, or I'm not working hard enough. You need to find a balance where it's exciting, but there's still something left. It's like Verlander in the eighth inning still can hit 97 when he's been coasting at 93, 94, 95. You have to have something in reserve, or when the game matters the most or the game's on the line, you got nothing left.
Hey man, it's great talking to you.
It's great talking to you. Always, whether we're at a Super Bowl, a World Series, or after a World Series, I mean, I love your takes on things, and I'm a fan of what you do, and so thanks for having me on.
All right, buddy. Go enjoy your fam.
I will. I have had two very short people walking around outside my office over the last whatever it's been, and they're ready to start piling on Dad.
Folks, thanks for listening at The Volume Sports. Check us out on Twitter, subscribe, review, line up, do whatever you got to do, and listen to Joe's podcast. We'll see you later. Volume.